From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are VOA National Affairs Correspondent Chris Simpkins and Marketplace Senior Reporter Nancy Marshall Genzer. Welcome, Nancy and Chris. Well, here are the issues. The House passed a roughly $40 billion bill to deliver aid to Ukraine as it continues to face Russia's brutal assault. Analysts say the infusions must continue if they are to support President Volodymyr Zelensky's vow to either win or beat back Moscow's advances. As the West continues to massively support Ukraine, analysts are concerned it could deepen the toll on the global economy. President Joe Biden told Americans that curbing inflation is his top priority, as rising prices are a key political issue for the upcoming midterm elections. Meanwhile, Americans say they are anxious about the escalating prices of groceries, meat, gasoline, rent, and housing, and are fed up with supply shortages. Senate Republicans, joined by Democratic Senator Joe Manchin, blocked legislation intended to enshrine abortion protections into law ahead of a possible ruling this summer by a conservative majority Supreme Court striking down the Roe v. Wade decision. Abortion rights activists in recent days have gathered outside the homes of three conservative Supreme Court justices to protest Roe v. Wade's potential demise. U.S. states continue their political primary contest in the run-up to midterms later this year. In the state of Nebraska, former President Trump's endorsed candidate was defeated in a heated gubernatorial primary, and in West Virginia, the former president's pick was victorious over a fellow incumbent. President Biden says the U.S. is leading the world in responding to the next phase in the global pandemic. He virtually convened 10 heads of state and several industry leaders to seek commitments to fund the international response to the pandemic. But the U.S. comes to this summit without congressional funds. Well, those are the issues, and let's get started. Well, Nancy, the House passed a nearly $40 billion package for Ukraine, sending the bill to the Senate as lawmakers heed President Joe Biden's warning that U.S. cash to help the allied country will run out in just over a week. There are many humanitarian crises going on in the world. So why is the U.S. sending more funds to Ukraine? And what does it mean that the U.S. will run out of funds?
This is a war that is playing out across our TV and computer screens. It's just very hard to turn away. And so even the most anti-war Democrats and Republicans have supported this funding. And this House bill is $40 billion. And it includes more than twice the presidential drawdown authority funding that President Biden requested. And this is a funding that allows the president to just draw down and send Ukraine supplies that the U.S. already has, things like anti-aircraft Stinger missiles and the Javelin missiles that Ukraine has used to take out Russian tanks. So that gives you an idea of just how much support there is for Ukraine in Congress at this point.
Well, the U.S. and its allies, they're supplying a steady stream of this lethal weaponry into Ukraine to keep it in the fight against the Russian invasion. So are these weapons keeping Russia from advancing as they want it to?
I think it has. The war has not gone according to Russia's plan. Ukrainian forces were successful in pushing Russian forces out of the capital, and now they appear to be holding their own in fighting in the eastern part of the country, stopping Russian advances right now. So I don't think the U.S. has any other choice but to try to supply as much weaponry as they possibly can, knowing that the Ukrainian forces' supplies have been depleted. There have been lots of casualties on both sides. So we have to do something in the United States to keep that flow of arms going and to try to hold back the Russians from advancing further into Ukraine from where they stand right now.
And, you know, it's not just military aid that is in this bill. There's also money for refugee assistance, including English language classes, money for housing and trauma support, also money for medical support for these refugees. So it's really an all-encompassing package.
And I might add that, as Nancy mentioned, the $40 million, that's, you know, added to $13 billion that was already allocated. So we're talking about $53, $54 billion in U.S. commitment. And as she mentioned, it's not all military aid. There's a huge humanitarian crisis going on right now with millions of people being displaced. And I think this commitment of money, even though we don't know how it's going to be paid for, at least the $40 billion. There's no indication of how we're going to pay for that yet, but the money's needed, and we can't just allocate monies in drips and drabs because the humanitarian conditions are growing worse, I fear.
Yes, and in looking at that, you just really need to take a look at how the U.S. and its allies are viewing this war that is going on there in Ukraine. Are they seeing it as an interminable and unwinnable situation for all sides?
Well, you had the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres kind of playing down hopes for peace talks, at least right away. He said, quoting him here, "There will be a time when peace negotiations will take place. I do not see that in the immediate future, but I can say one thing, we will never give up." So he's kind of dampening expectations for progress on peace talks right away, but he certainly is going to keep trying.
And I think U.S. military officials here in Washington have acknowledged that this is going to be a long-term war. They don't see really any short-term ending to this or any kind of notion of peace negotiations at this point, especially when you have Russian forces advancing in some areas and Ukrainian leaders saying they're not willing to make any concessions towards Russia or allowing Russia to annex areas where they are presently controlling. So it's going to be a protracted war. And I think that's becoming a quite clear realization here among the administration officials and people over at the Pentagon.
And, you know, the UN is also getting the world ready for a possible food crisis. And it's warning that since Ukraine was such a major exporter of commodities like wheat, you could have real food shortages in Africa, which was a major importer of that wheat. So it seems like the UN is really trying to warn people that this could last a very long time and they should try to prepare as best they can.
Yes, and that brings us to our next topic, where President Biden and congressional Democrats, they're struggling to make a dent on inflation as rising prices are affecting their political support ahead of the midterm elections. So in looking at this, what is the president's strategy to fight this inflation that we are experiencing here in the U.S.?
Well, the thing is, he can't really do much directly because the Federal Reserve is the one that really, you know, the government institution that sets interest rates and is really in charge of fighting inflation. And President Biden has proposed things like domestic manufacturing of things like computer chips to try to ease those supply chain snags that are pushing up prices. But you can't build a chip factory overnight. You know, these things take a few years. And as far as the Federal Reserve goes, it has been raising interest rates in an effort to cool down the economy and get people and businesses to spend less, which cools down the economy, brings down inflation. The Fed doesn't have any power over supply chains either. It can only work on the monetary policy and making money more expensive. But if there's still supply chain issues, that's way beyond the Fed's purview.
And also what we're looking at is inflation staying at a 40-year high. As of April, it was 8.3%. So is this a trend that historically is normal?
Yeah, there's really nothing normal about this time, Kim, I will say. You know, I mean, as I was mentioning, this inflation is partly caused by supply chain issues, and Ukraine certainly plays a part in that, and Russia, for that matter, as a supplier of energy and certain metals. So that's certainly pushing prices up. And we had food prices up 1% last month, and 8.8% for the year. Energy prices were up 11%. You know, gasoline prices alone were up more than 18% for the month, and that was partly caused by the war in Ukraine. Yeah, this is not normal. There are some thoughts that perhaps inflation peaked in March because it is coming down. It's still high, but it's a little less high each month, but there's really no guarantee of that.
I mean, I think inflation is at unprecedented numbers, a 40-year high. I remember back in the late 70s, mid to late 70s, we experienced inflation and high interest rates. But it's really a difficult period because wages are only rising at about 5%, inflation running at 8%. And Americans are really feeling it in their pockets. I mean, just the cost of food alone, with milk up 14%. Year on year, eggs up 22%, chicken 16%, beef 13%. So when Americans are going to the grocery stores and filling up their automobiles, they're paying roughly $400, $500 more a month right now. And there's no end in sight to these rising prices.
And there's one particular measure of inflation that the Fed relies on. It's kind of the Fed's favorite inflation measure. It's a core inflation, and that strips out very volatile energy and food prices. And that does seem to be ebbing just a bit. It's rising just a little bit less. It was up 0.3% in April, less than what economists estimated. But the services part of that, things like restaurants and bars and so on, those prices are still up. So it's really still a mixed picture.
And I think it's also reflected in what we're seeing in the equity markets. Huge losses in the last few days as the market clearly looks at the future. And the future is very uncertain with the war in Ukraine, higher interest rates coming. And corporations don't like higher interest rates because they cut into profitability. And then you have so much uncertainty that we might be headed to a recession. If we raise these interest rates too much, the economy slows down, consumers stop spending, we might have a looming recession next year. So I think there's still a lot of very much uncertainty in where the economy is going in the next 12 months.
And the Fed has to be really careful, because if it steps on the brakes to cool off the economy too much and really hikes interest rates dramatically, as you say, that could lead to a recession, which would lead to layoffs. And the unemployment rate for Black workers in the U.S. is still almost twice the rate for white workers.
And looking at the upcoming November midterm elections, how is inflation going to affect the midterms?
It's not going to be good news for Democrats. That's partly why President Biden has, you know, mentioned it so much and said, he gets it and he's really trying to help. But, you know, when consumers see how much gas prices are up, they drive past the gas station all the time, go to the grocery store, see how much more they're spending for food, they're going to blame it on somebody. And most likely it'll be the Democrats.
I think to counter that, President Biden is saying a lot of this is out of my control, but he's emphasizing now that the Republicans really don't have a plan to fight inflation. And he's also emphasizing the fact that Republicans had said that they wanted to raise taxes on most Americans in order to pay for a lot of the things that the government is spending on. So that's the counter message, I think, for President Biden.
Time seems to be quickly flowing in terms of looking ahead to midterm. So we will just have to see how this all pans out for the Democrats. Well, it's time now for a quick break. And when we return, an unsuccessful effort by Democratic lawmakers to directly rebuff what they say is an unfavorable Supreme Court draft opinion. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype, Marketplace Senior Reporter Nancy Marshall-Genzer and VOA National Affairs Correspondent Chris Simpkins. While Senate Democrats were unsuccessful in passing their Women's Protection Health Act, so what is their next step as the Supreme Court may possibly reverse the Roe v. Wade abortion rights legislation?
They're really going to try to drive this home to voters, what's at stake. And I think they're going to really try to appeal to suburban college-educated women. That's a key swing vote right there. The Democrats knew they were going to lose, but they wanted that as what's known in Washington as a message vote to get Republicans on record as opposing this. And polls do show a majority of Americans support Roe v. Wade, but things get a little murkier because most of them also think there should be some limits on abortion, but they're just not clear on what those limits should be.
Are Democrats hoping to see the expected Supreme Court decision on Roe v. Wade overturned?
It's not that they would overturn it. And the court has said this. Look, if you don't like our rulings, pass new legislation establishing that Roe v. Wade is law, establish a national law that says abortion is legal. The chances of that are zero, especially if Republicans take over the House and possibly the Senate this fall. There's no way that would be passed in a Republican-controlled legislature.
With 53% of registered voters polling in a political poll said that they would not like to see Roe v. Wade overturned. And I think the message from the Democrats is to voters that you need to elect people on the local, state, and federal levels who are going to support a woman's right to have an abortion.
And also, if we could just touch on if this decision does come to be, what it really means. Are they actually going to be passing this on to the states to make the decision?
Yeah, it would be up to the states. And there are a number of states that have trigger laws where abortion would automatically become illegal in those states if the Supreme Court strikes down Roe v. Wade. Then the question is, would those states restrict people who are pregnant from traveling to other states to get abortions or from getting abortion pills in the mail? That's the next question.
And just this year, Kim, 10 states adopted laws restricting abortion rights. And on the other side, you've seen some states like California. They're among 8 states that have enacted laws just this year that protect abortion rights. So we will continue to see a lot of activity in the states. And again, the message is, from the Democrats, you need to elect people at the state level who support abortion rights if you don't want to see these rights taken away from you.
But it's not really clear if that message is going to get through because, again, inflation is really uppermost in a lot of voters' minds because they see these higher prices every day. They pass by the gas station, they fill up their vehicles, and they're paying $10 more to fill up their vehicle than they're used to. They're paying more for food at the grocery store. These are things they deal with all the time, whereas abortion is, for many people, just sort of in the background.
Yes, and I also wanted to touch on the abortion rights activists protesting outside of the homes of 3 conservative Supreme Court justices. The demonstration sparked a response from the White House that justices shouldn't have to worry about their personal safety. But Republicans have accused the administration of not condemning violent threats. So what is your take on this?
Well, it's legal. People can picket outside of a Supreme Court justice's home. As long as they don't actually block access to a driveway, they are supposed to keep moving and be out of the way. But it is legal for people to protest.
It's a tough situation because you're seeing increasing numbers of protests. And I think Merrick Garland, the attorney general, announced yesterday that he would ask the Marshals Service to tighten security for the justices in light of some of the things that are happening. I was up on Capitol Hill just the other day, and the Supreme Court building looks like a fortress with a huge fence around it. The streets are closed to traffic, and there are different numbers of protesters. The thing is now, we want to allow protests, but we don't want the violence. And the White House has emphasized that they do not accept violence. And we have seen some violence at a couple of abortion clinics. And we just don't want these demonstrations to turn in a negative way.
And just want to get in our last two topics very quickly. The first one being the latest primaries, one in Nebraska, the other in West Virginia. While these two contests did not make national headlines as the Ohio Senate battle last week, they did bring to light vicious campaigns that saw the Trump-backed candidates use the former president's endorsement as a shield against a wide range of criticisms, as some people are saying. For one candidate in the GOP gubernatorial contest, this did not work. State Senator and self-funding businessman Charles Herbster was defeated by University of Nebraska Regent Jim Pillen, who won the party's nomination. Are these significant developments regarding Trump-endorsed candidates?
Yeah, certainly. If you look first at the Nebraska gubernatorial primary, Mr. Trump's choice, as you said, Charles Herbster, was accused of groping women, and Trump has faced accusations like that himself, and he still endorsed Herbster and held rallies for him in Nebraska. Voters rejected Herbster. Jim Pillen, who won, was endorsed by the outgoing governor. And of course, he will probably become Nebraska's next governor because Democrats haven't elected a Democrat as governor since the 1990s. But yeah, that was a loss for a Trump-backed candidate.
I guess it's been a mixed bag for Trump. These May primaries are a key test to see how much influence the former president still holds over the Republican Party. His endorsed candidate in Ohio won, and there's some key primaries coming up on the 17th and the 24th of May in North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Georgia, where Trump has gone all in on a few candidates. So I think in the next couple of weeks, we will have a much better idea of the influence of former President Trump on the Republican Party.
The candidate Trump backed in the West Virginia congressional primary did win. This was a race that actually pitted two Republican incumbents against each other because of redistricting. And Trump's candidate, Congressman Alex Mooney, defeated Congressman David McKinley. McKinley had actually voted for the bipartisan infrastructure package. And he also voted for creation of the House committee investigating the January 6th attacks on the Capitol. And that upset Trump. So Trump decided to endorse Congressman Mooney, and Mooney won.
Interesting. Well, we'll just have to see how influential the former president will be in the months to come. And in our last topic, President Biden says the U.S. is leading the world in responding to the next phase in the global pandemic. He virtually convened 10 heads of state and several industry leaders to seek commitments to fund the international response to the pandemic. So how significant is this summit right now?
The Biden administration is trying to kind of gin up support for pandemic preparedness when a lot of people are distracted. Testing is down. Vaccinations are down. Really, the Biden administration isn't bringing a lot of money to the table because its request for a coronavirus package is stuck in Congress. And the Biden administration asked for more than $22 billion. And lawmakers came up with $10 billion measure. And that's even stuck on Capitol Hill.
And I think it's also an effort by the Biden administration to turn some of the focus on trying to get more worldwide vaccination rates up. Vaccination officials had hoped that the world would reach a 70% vaccination rate, but that doesn't appear to be happening. But also Biden wants to work with these ASEAN nations on security in the Pacific region and try to focus on China's growing military influence in the South China Sea. And I think some of these countries want more assistance from the United States military, but that's yet to come.
But the Biden administration is making one commitment that's not a monetary commitment, but the National Institutes of Health is going to license what it calls its stabilized spike protein technology to other countries. And that's a big component of vaccines and treatments for COVID. That will help other countries try to produce their own vaccines.
Yes, and also to add, the U.S. co-hosted the summit along with Germany, Indonesia, Senegal, and Belize. We'll have to end the show on that note. My thanks go to Marketplace Senior Reporter Nancy Marshall Genzer and VOA National Affairs Correspondent Chris Simpkins. I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for joining us for Issues in the News.